It is absolutely disgusting what they do, and I think that it's only going to get worse because Bitcoin is a threat to them. Most of what we see that gets labeled as quote-unquote capitalism is really corporatism and is just as evil as socialism or anything else. The solution is sound money. It doesn't matter if that's Bitcoin or not. The fact that Congress passed a bill that would effectively ban the use of a website is incredibly authoritarian.
You wrote a book, The Liberty Solution. First of all, like, let's get a little bit into your book. What's the core message of the book? Like, what's the core principles that you can give us from the book? What inspired you to write it? And then, like, when we get into this, then we later can get a little bit also in Bitcoin.
Yeah. So, at its core, the book is mainly a philosophical treatise on liberty and natural law. We as a people, particularly in the U.S., we have this misguided understanding of what liberty actually is. We seem to misunderstand that liberty means that people will act in a way that you don't like, as long as they're not hurting anybody. They have the right to do those sorts of things. And in modern political American discourse, and I'm sure it's like this all across the globe, rather large degree, but we seem to think that liberty means that which I like and agree with. And that's not the case. You'll get your typical conservatives talking about, let's ban burning the American flag, or let's ban this or ban that. And then you got people on the left, the lefties that are all, let's ban guns. Let's make sure that we use the state to uphold this doctrine that we agree with. That's not what liberty is. Liberty is taking sole dominion over your own life and not infringing upon the right of another person to do the same. So just because somebody is acting in a way that you find morally reprehensible, outright, deplorable, as long as they're not bringing harm to another person, direct harm, then they have the right to do that. So, if somebody wants to, a simple example that I give is if somebody wants to, drink to excess on a very daily basis and just get sloppy drunk, that's their right to do it. And some people might argue, well, he's harming himself. Well, he owns himself and he has the right to engage in those harmful behaviors. You could extend this a step further to things like drug prohibition or substance control and scheduling by the state. It all is exactly the same thing fundamentally. So just because somebody is in using a substance that you don't like, they have the right to do that because of the fact that they own themselves. And I expand upon this in part one of the book, highlighting different areas in which the U.S. government infringes upon the rights of individuals, whether that be TSA screenings, gun background checks, taxation, you name it. And then in part two, I apply those principles into what I consider real world applications. So what would it look like if we took liberty to its logical conclusions? And I argue that that would be reminiscent of what is called anarcho-capitalism. And for those who aren't, privy on the philosophy, basically, it means no government exists, no centralized authority, no monopoly on violence to coerce people into compliance. But it also means self-ownership. It means taking responsibility for yourself and for your loved ones. And I also make it very clear as to what capitalism is, because there's a lot of misunderstandings. There's a lot of stigma around what capitalism is. And most of what we see that gets labeled as quote unquote capitalism is really corporatism and is just as evil as, socialism or anything else. So capitalism is nothing more than the free and voluntary exchange of a private property within a free market. And anything that's beyond that scope doesn't fit the criteria. So what anarcho-capitalism really means is, you know, you taking sole dominion over your life, you're responsible for your life and everything about your life, and you have the freedom to exchange your property. That's all that it means. And I also dig a little bit deeper as to what anarchy means and how it is also stigmatized and misrepresented as being some sort of Mad Max style, you know, apocalyptic world where, you know, warmongers have taken over, and how there's, you know, slavery everywhere. And my thought on that is that that is actually what we have right now with statism and any sort of centralized government. So that's kind of ultimately what the book is about. And I think that in particular, what, you know, what your listeners might be interested in is how money changes without a centralized monopoly on violence like the government. How do we engage in that sort of transaction if we don't have the U.S. Federal Reserve and the U.S. Treasury, you know, printing these wonderful Federal Reserve notes that we have, and you know the euro in Europe? How do we negotiate that medium of exchange? And it is something that I explore a bit. And honestly, it would ultimately yield a much more satisfactory quality of life for everybody.
100% agree then with that. And I often talk about Bitcoin in the podcast. I mean, almost every podcast episode is almost primarily about Bitcoin. There are a few exceptions to that. And I had a few podcast episodes back discussing about what is freedom actually, like what does it mean? What does freedom mean? And for me, and then you touched on it, I mean, conceptually, for me, is freedom goes as far as the freedom from someone else has started. So as a small example for that, if I don't use my seatbelt in my car, it's totally up to me. Like nobody, no third party should be able to tell me to click my seatbelt, because it's my body. I can do whatever I want to do with it. And if I choose to do the seatbelt, I choose to do it. If I'm not, then I don't. But I cannot drive with 200 kilometers per hour through a street where there are kids playing or something like that. This would be something irresponsible, because I could damage someone else's life. And there where it might make sense to have like guidance or at least like signs that like, okay, drive here slower, because your freedom expands over to someone else's freedoms. Is that what you described? Like the freedom goes as far as someone else's freedom starts, or is that something different?
No, I would echo most of what you said. Where I would disagree is that while it is certainly a bad idea to drive 200 kilometers per hour past a neighborhood park where children are playing, as long as nobody gets injured as a result of that, you do technically have the right to do that. Now, we could get into the nuances of you know, who owns the street that you're driving on, because at the end of the day, there is, you know, in my ideal world, there's no such thing as quote unquote public property. There's either nature's property, which hasn't been claimed, which has, you know, is just as virgin as the day that the earth was born. And then there is private property. So private property is anything that has had labor introduced to it to transform it from the way that nature left it to us. So in my ideal world, somebody would own those streets and they would have the right to dictate, you know, your speed limits as terms of use, which you would voluntarily agree to as a condition for utilizing that road. But ultimately, as long as nobody is injured, then you do have the right to do it. Is it dangerous? Yes. Should it be frowned upon? Absolutely. Should it be ostracized even? Yeah, probably. But as long as nobody is harmed, you do have the right to do that. And going back to the private owner and operator of that street, by violating their terms of use, you are in effect trespassing. So you would be, there is an argument to be made that if anybody is harmed in this scenario, it's the owner of the street and not the children that are playing, because they actually didn't have any direct harm. Now, if you hit one of those children, that's a completely different story. Does that make sense?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, when everybody respects the private property and everybody is like, okay, this is a street where I only can drive this limit. It's owned by this individual. And he says, okay, this is an area where kids should play and I should not drive as fast. But what if there is, like, in that world, is there any centralized authority on a monopoly on violence, as you said? Is there anything, stuff like that? Because when there's a conflict coming up, how do we manage that? Like, how do we come up with solutions for conflicts in, if they're like, okay, but maybe this, like, I hear it so many times of like neighborhoods, like the one neighbor is like, no, that's my side or this, like, there's so many weird reasons to go to court. Is there in such a solutions, are there private courts? Is there like a private institutional courts? How is this side of the story working?
Yeah, so you hit it right on. And this doesn't, again, this is all theoretical. And so any solution that I present either here or in my book is just an idea. There are actually infinite number of ideas that we could come up with that could serve as a potential solution to all this. What I have kind of laid out a little bit in the book is private arbitration, private courts. And we even have this to a degree with alternative dispute resolution. So instead of bogging something down in a tort court, people get together with a third-party mediator or even an arbitrator to look over everything and come to either a compromise or, in the case of arbitration, actually make a ruling, even though it's not a government judge making that ruling. The parties agreed to go to arbitration and agreed to whatever the outcome was. It's a voluntary agreement. And we could expand that to essentially be the entire court system, where if somebody has a grievance against somebody else, they could petition that court. All the fees would have to be covered by the parties involved in some way or another by agreement. They would agree to follow the ruling one way or the other before it happens. In the cases of like this, it would be pretty straightforward and simple. Okay, he set this limit, you exceeded that limit willingly and at a, double, triple, whatever the speed limit was. This is pretty objective here. You violated his terms of service, and therefore we're going to enforce what penalties he lays out for violating those terms of service. Now, there is no monopoly on violence to make sure that this happens. And so let's say I took you to court for speeding on my streets. I wouldn't have like cops come to your house and invoke violence on you if you didn't pay me what was deemed to be paid from that court ruling. But what I could do is I could publicly ostracize you and say, hey, look, this person went to court with me. It was ruled in my favor and he owes me this amount of money per that ruling. And he has not paid me. Now, your reputation in this world has actual value. And what I'm doing is I am publicly depreciating your reputation as somebody who can't be trusted, which means that all the other relationships that you would voluntarily have are now kind of questioning what type of person that you are. And so some of them might want to end their relationship with you, or at least keep you at a different distance. So this could impact your future business dealings. This could impact any future relationships that you have, public or professional, personal, whatever. If it's bad enough, like in the cases of murder, rape, like legitimate evil acts being committed, not just but legitimate evil acts, your landlord could kick you out of your house. Your bank could close all your accounts and just send you all your money and say, I'm not going to deal with you anymore. Your employer could instantly terminate you. Your life would be destroyed without having this centralized monopoly on violence because of public ostracism based off of what you actually did.
I love that idea. I mean, I always argue for more freedom. I'm always, whenever I'm in a group of people, I'm always the one arguing for more freedom and less state interference. A lot of the arguments that I hear against it is like, how do we protect the ones that are coming? I mean, this is a minority. We have to always capture, like, we should not make rules for, like, not get in a direction where we only make rules for a minority and put it on a whole pack, if you know what I mean. But what if, like, in that kind of a world, for people that come with disabilities on the world where they just cannot have so much value for society as somebody else. And this is, like, as I said, small amount of people. The most are just lazy, as I see it. And they should be more incentivized by a more incentivizing system. But what do we do with those kind of people? Is there, like, just private institutions that would naturally care for them because they are good human beings?
Yeah. And I would also argue that human beings are naturally, like, a bit on the altruist side. We do care for our fellow human. What has kind of desensitized that has been the government's involvement with literally everything, where, oh, don't worry about it, the government will take care of it. If there was no government to take care of it, then I firmly believe that we as humans would identify people who are going through very hard times, either by or through no fault of their own, or maybe they made bad decisions and they're trying to learn from them. People genuinely are very charitable for the most part, even despite the fact that the government has stolen more and more of our property, you know, as the years have gone on. I forget the actual numbers, but I broke it down in a later chapter in my book. Despite the fact that tax revenues, quote unquote, or theft has gone up significantly, even adjusted for the devaluation of the dollar, charitable donations have also skyrocketed. And if we stopped this theft from the government to begin with, then I think that people would be even more charitable than they already are and already have proven themselves to be. And unlike, you know, the government-controlled charities, you know, you have to do these sorts of things to maintain your nonprofit status and blah, blah, blah. Those regulations wouldn't exist, and so they would actually have the ability to focus on really helping other people, and they'd have a fiduciary duty to helping those people. And then once they are back on their feet, you know, they're better off for it instead of, you know, getting some government handout, which essentially perpetuates the issue you know, doesn't actually resolve anything. I think that private charities would be a great mechanism, especially in an anarchist type world without government control and regulation, to make sure that they're hitting these and this, you know, regulatory burdens just to be a charitable organization.
I always argue that Bitcoin is non-political, even though I see a lot of arguments against that, actually, because Bitcoin incentivizes some behaviors. For example, Bitcoin incentivizes low time preference against high time preference. Bitcoin incentivizes, like, to keep your money and not spend it on dumb shit you don't need. Bitcoin also incentivizes, as I think, freedom to a certain extent, because it's, for me, and I want to get into it if you see it the same way, for me, it's the only real property we can actually hold, because it's the only property, even if someone is putting a gun to your head, you can still choose to keep it. With a house, someone can shoot you and then can just take the house, like, because it's physical. Yeah. The Bitcoin you can keep in your head and they can shoot you, but maybe they shoot away your Bitcoin also. What I want to go with, like, is that kind of a idea, what you describe in the book and what we described now in the first 20 minutes of the podcast, is Bitcoin bringing us a little bit closer to that future?
Absolutely. You know, Bitcoin will always be the OG of cryptos, right? I mean, it was the first one. You know, it revolutionized what money potential could be. And I think, you know, you've seen since the inception of Bitcoin, all of these other cryptos come out, some having real utility, others not so much, like Dogecoin. You know, it's just based off of hype. Okay, but most people don't realize that a lot of the crypto projects that we see, the altcoin projects, are actually based off of, you know, rather real utility. And much like investing in a company stock, you know, there is some inherent value tied to that crypto asset that can help revolutionize the crypto industry even more. And ultimately, what cryptocurrency is it is competition in being born into the medium of exchange market, which governments have always had a monopoly on. And that's what makes it so revolutionary, is that before, governments controlled what money was. They defined what money was, whether that was the Roman Empire, you know, taking what their Roman coins were, the purity of them as far as, you know, silver and gold content would be, and then saying, oh yeah, we're going to decree that we're going to clip this a little bit for, you know, for justifiable reasons, I assure you. And so it ultimately, they ended up clipping out all of the actual intrinsic value of it and making it nothing more than a tin coin that doesn't have any value whatsoever, which is what ultimately caused the Roman Empire to fall. And we see that, we saw that in ancient Rome. We see that now with, you know, the Federal Reserve, the World Bank, all of these centralized banks essentially having a complete fiat currency. You know, and what's even kind of crazier is these modern monetary theorists coming out like, this is what the future of money is. No, this is not what the future of money is. This is legitimately the track record of fiat money has been, and it's been abysmal. But because cryptocurrency has been able to become an actual competitor into an otherwise monopolistic environment, that means that people start looking at their government currency with a little bit less sparkle in their eyes. And I think that as time goes on, and you've already seen it from 2009 to now in 2024, people have started to understand the value that Bitcoin has and the value that other cryptocurrencies have. I mean, Bitcoin is back over 60,000 right now, and yet we still celebrate Bitcoin Pizza Day, where somebody spent 10,000 Bitcoin on two pizzas, 10,000 Bitcoin. You know, you take all of this and you give it to the average person and say, this is what real money can do. Then they start to wonder about those little Federal Reserve notes in their wallet and the balance that shows on their bank account. And that's the beauty of capitalism generally, but I think that it's really indicative of how powerful an entity is that has control over the money.
Yeah, it's I totally agree with that. Like, I mean, the only part that like I don't see a lot of value in the altcoin market right now. I mean, I could be wrong, and I as I came into the crypto market like 4 or 5 years ago, then I was like Bitcoin, had a lot of other altcoins in my portfolio. Then I went Bitcoin only. Then I went really toxic against all the altcoins. Now I'm more like a free market proponent, where I'm like, okay, I have only Bitcoin, but everything else like is also fair game. If they will have long term real utility and value in the market, they will sustain. Let's see where it goes. If they don't, they don't. It's like the free market. I also don't get why an art like Mona Lisa or something like that, which has obviously a lot of value for people, I would never pay anything for that painting, because it has no value for me. But that's where the free market comes in, right? You have some people like only this, some people only like this. Let's see what the future holds up. I don't see the proof of decentralization on a lot of the other cryptos, and that's why I'm like scared away of them, because I see a lot of things. For example, the second most decentralized, as I see it, or the most powerful from the altcoins is Ethereum, and then I'm like, okay, they switch completely their proof of work to proof of stake model. They already moved back a transaction, and I'm like, okay, maybe I'm switching the central bank for like a private one that's maybe even worse. I don't know. But I like Bitcoin, where like there's nobody manipulating it, and Bitcoin has kind of proven that it's actually decentralized, especially with the block size wars. This was a big one for me. Like without the block size wars, I think the provability of Bitcoin that it's so decentralized would be different. But as we come back to free market, like Bitcoin can also fail. And that's what I'm trying to get across my podcasts more and more, where I'm like, okay, yes, I'm all about Bitcoin. I love Bitcoin. I would always support Bitcoin. But I could also be wrong. But what I'm not wrong is about my values, my thinking of the free market, and that we need sound money and the evolution of sound money. And that's why I like the Bitcoin Standard, the book from Saverin, so much, because it talks about like the history of sound money and how we have like drifted off a little bit with the fiat notes, and how bad it is. And even if Bitcoin fails tomorrow, I will still have the podcast and still will advocate for sound money. We probably need a better solution then, but it would be really hard. It would be a devastating day, but I would not stop to advocate for sound money. Then we just need another form of that, even though I definitely don't believe that Bitcoin will go away anytime soon.
Yeah, I completely agree. And the thing is, like you said it, the solution is sound money. It doesn't matter if that's Bitcoin or not. Anything that's sound for a monetary medium of exchange will work, as long as there's no monopoly over it. That competition is really what will help ensure that we don't get into like what we saw with the Roman Empire with cutting of coins, and, you know, ultimately ending up on a purely fiat standard.
Yeah. What did actually initially, like, did you ever always thought like that, or was there some event in your life where like was driving more towards the freedom side of things? Is there something like that formed your brain into this direction?
That is a simple question with a bit of a long-winded answer, so I'll try and keep it a little short. But you know, I grew up in a typical conservative household. You know, American conservative household, red, white, and blue, you know, love the 4th of July, you know, that type of family. We always voted Republican because freedom, yay. And I remember, you know, when I was in high school, I really idolized the nuances of, you know, at least what history was being told to me about America's founding and championing of individual liberty and this, that, and the other. So it was always kind of something that resonated with me. Then I joined the military right after high school. And that was the first time I started really questioning some things. But I was still very much a Republican, you know, very much somebody who loved and supported the Constitution of the United States of America, and thought that I was serving my country. But I'd see a couple things, and it would just trigger something in my brain, like, this doesn't seem right. And I got out of the military, and then I kept watching what current events were leading to. And it kind of just evolved from there. I became a bit more libertarian as time went on. I decided to officially stop calling myself a Republican in 2016 when Donald Trump won the nomination. I was just like, this is reality TV. There's nothing real here. And 2016 was the first time I voted libertarian. And I kept that ideal, and I became a gun rights advocate. I had a podcast for Lone Star Gun Rights, which is a grassroots gun rights organization in the state of Texas. Our main goal at that time was to get permitless carry passed, where you could carry a gun on your person without having to beg the state for permission to do so first. And I remember in, I think it was 2017-ish, there was a tragedy at a high school in Santa Fe, Texas, where somebody had, killed a bunch of students, and it was really tragic. Following that, there was a gun rights rally that we organized called Carry for Our Kids. And I was a speaker at that event, and I gave my speech on liberty and, rights and all that. And somebody in the audience afterwards came to me and said, "Hey, I think you should write a book on this, because what you said was really profound, and it just made a whole lot of sense. And I'd like, if you could put this in book form and just expand on it to every direction that you can, I think that would be really awesome." And so the next day I started writing my book, which ultimately became The Liberty Solution. And as I'm writing it, I think when I first started writing it, I called myself more of a minarchist. I would often say I'm 3 degrees separated from an anarchist. And as I did all the research for my book, I stumbled upon a writer by the name of Murray N. Rothbard. And that changed my life, because Murray Rothbard articulated things that he articulated solutions to the very few things that I could not come up with reasons that the government shouldn't exist in those areas. Like we talked about courts or police and things like that. Those were the few areas where I was like, I don't see anything other than the government being able to control these things, fairly, quote unquote. And then I read Murray Rothbard's For a New Liberty, and he laid it all out for me. And I was like, well, that's it. I'm an anarchist now. There's no more excuses. I have the solutions, at least ideas for those solutions and how they could work. And that's kind of my philosophical evolution, from, my high school days till now.
If you are listening to this podcast, you might be wondering, what is actually the setup look like of Robin? Or how can I improve my Bitcoin setup? And there's two things. You have to buy Bitcoin from the right source, and you have to store Bitcoin the right way. Let's focus on the first thing, how to buy Bitcoin. It's simple. Have a Bitcoin-only exchange. Don't deal with the shitcoin exchanges. Don't deal with an exchange that has an own token or something like that. Be on a Bitcoin-only exchange. I use 21 Bitcoin. 21 Bitcoin is, for me, the best partner for that. And now, where do you store Bitcoin? Bitcoin should be stored on a hardware wallet, on a self-custody solution where you yourself hold your keys, and it should be a cold wallet. So that's my simple solutions. That's a BitBox. You just put your Bitcoin on there, back up your seed phrase, and you are better than 95% of all Bitcoin hodlers. If you have more than 1,000 euros in Bitcoin, it's an absolutely must have. One last thing before we get back to the video. I'm really passionate about meeting other Bitcoiners. And there's an amazing opportunity in middle of Europe in June, the Bitcoin Prague Conference. It's the best and biggest Bitcoin-only conference in whole of Europe. For all Americans, please visit Europe and visit this place in June. For all Europeans, it's a must-go anyways. You are so close to the Bitcoin Prague Conference, you basically have to come. I will do interviews there, and I would love to meet you all there. Use code Robin for all my sponsors to get discounts, and use the links down in the description. I love it so much. There's always like this points in the life where like the life is kind of formed. And I love also that you wrote a book. A really selfish question now, because I'm also in the process of thinking of all the things I've learned in the last like 26 years where I'm on this planet, and thinking of like a book, and I have like 4 directions where I want to go with that book. What tips do you have for someone that wants to write his first book and has no clue about writing a book? or publishing a book, do you have any like tips or like anything that you were like, oh, I wish I've known that before, anything like that?
How much time do you have? I will tell you this. Probably one of the best things that you can do is create a solid outline before you ever put pen to paper. Always remember that you are always your worst critic. So after you're done writing something and you go back and read it, remember that you're going to be critiquing yourself more than anybody else on the planet will be. And so because of that, I would always find somebody that you trust to kind of read things, but make sure that they understand that you're looking for criticism. You know, you're looking for ways to improve it. Don't just tell me it's good because you're my friend or whatever. Somebody that will be honest with you, whether that's, you know, the nuances of a sentence structure or whether the whole idea just seems bogus, that's fine. You can take that feedback. And even if you disagree with the feedback, it might give you even something that you can address in a subsequent set of paragraphs. Like, some might argue this, this, and this, and to that I would say, you know, something like that. And then I would say be patient, because I'm working on my second book now, and I have hit the worst writer's block I have ever had. I have not written a word in about 3 months now. It happens. Be patient with it. Let it come. Do not force it, because that's going to take away from your overall message. I know that there are some things that are a bit time sensitive, especially if you're writing nonfiction, you know, because something could change in the crypto industry as you're writing that changes a nuance of a direction that you were going. So be patient with it. If you need to make those changes, make those changes. But don't feel like, oh, I have to get this done immediately because, you know, if I don't, then things could change. And then what am I going to do? Well, everything's going to change at some point. So take your time with it, step by step. Make sure you have a good outline. Don't be afraid to edit your outline either as you're going. But just something to help keep your focus and make sure that I'll tell you, whenever you're writing, things are going to start jumbling up in your head like crazy. You're going to be in the middle of a paragraph and like, oh crap, where do I want to go with this? And that's kind of where your outline will help, because then you can, instead of writing it on your actual draft, you can kind of type out a couple of bullet points and be like, okay, how do I want to go about this? So that's the advice that I would give you.
It's amazing. I've actually started just writing chapters, and I think I have now like 30 or something, like I not writing chapters, just like the headlines of it, and the short like 5-sentence thing where I'm like, okay, I could write this, and I'm like now just in the process of finding ideas and finding directions I can go with. I did not read any, like did not write anything down. And the amazing thing is also like just the process of starting, okay, I want to write a book, started something amazing. Whenever I have a thought, I'm like, oh shit, this is something really nice. I'm just writing it down in this note, and this, like, it started with like half a page. Now it's like already 10 pages long, this thing. And it will be, I think it will be more complicated to have like a focused book than like, I think I will not struggle with finding content, more like with making good content and making that. What I also really like is that you said like timely content, because I always try, also with the podcast, I try to not put anything in there that is like current. Like I will never talk with guests about like, oh, this just happened in Bitcoin, let's talk about it, because I want this every podcast episode to be digestible also in there like a year or 2 years. Obviously, yeah, some things will change as the Bitcoin price. When we talk about Bitcoin price, we mentioned the Bitcoin price now. I feel like in 4 years, when someone watches this, will be like a joke to him that the Bitcoin price was at 60,000. But yeah, so like I try always to everything I do to be timeless, to be evergreen, because this is how I just function, except of my Twitter page. But this is something different. I think a tweet cannot live long anyways. In the sense of social media and content, which is also really interesting for freedom, because it's kind of in this digital revolution that I think brings more freedom to our world. Because when we look back, we only had this like media companies and only this like scripted things. And now we have individual creators and a decentralized way of getting information, more decentralized. They are still living on centralized platforms, but at least there's a person that I can directly follow. Do you also see this? Like, do you see like a decentralization of content creators, a decentralization of individual reporters, and not like one big media house that has like a head on top of it that controls what's in the newspaper or what's not? And more like, okay, I can follow him. I can follow Derek on Twitter. I can follow Robert on YouTube. Like, is this like also like a kind of a decentralization of our world and brings more freedom?
I can see it in its infancy. I say that with a little bit of caution. Like YouTube is a Google company, very much in bed with governments across the world, especially for combating what they call misinformation, which is anything that goes against the propagandized narrative. You think of something like Twitter, where the owner has said that this is a free speech platform. It is better. It is a better option than, say, YouTube is. And of course, this is, you know, the content format notwithstanding, just trying to get your message out there. It's better to an extent, but at the same time, I would not say that Twitter is a free speech platform. There are still people getting banned for saying things that aren't really that terrible. It's still better for people who are more liberty-minded to a very large degree. But I think that it still has a long way to go because, you know, freedom of speech really means freedom of speech, saying whatever you feel like saying. And I get the whole freedom of speech, not freedom of reach thing. And yeah, absolutely. As a capitalist myself, I understand that Elon has the authority to dictate what is allowed and isn't allowed on his website. I'm not saying that he doesn't. But I will say that saying that it's a free speech haven is a bit of a misnomer. There are people that I've seen get banned for ultimately rather superfluous things. It's getting better. It has been a very long process, and I have seen some improvement along those lines. I still think that it has a long way to go. But with that, I will say that as far as social media generally is concerned, Twitter does have the most freedom for the content creator among the mainstream social media platforms. So I use Twitter very heavily. I know that there are some more decentralized and even like fully open source social medias, like I think Mastodon's one. I don't know. There's a couple that are just kind of out there, but the thing is they don't have a lot of users, so it's, as a content creator, you can't really rely on those, even though they may be objectively better for freedom of speech and saying what you want. Whenever you go to a place like that, you're not going to get, you know, the engagement that you're otherwise wanting and needing as a content creator, especially if you're trying to make a career out of content creation, which I by no means am. But, with content creation, you need engagement. With engagement, you need people. And with, you know, that means that you're going to have to be on something that has the people. So, Twitter is the best option from all of the social media, mainstream social media networks. But I still think that it has a ways to go.
It has a long way to go. And I full heartedly agree with that. It's for me fascinating. I feel like I am on Instagram, YouTube, on Twitter. And I think Instagram is the worst place. I get really, really fast something taken off. I feel like, even though my reach is not as big on the as on the other platforms, which is also like, I feel like when the reach is higher, that you should get banned fast because people recognize it. But yeah, it's all of the sudden not so. YouTube, I'm more careful, especially with the shorts that I put out. I notice when there's some word in there that they don't like shit, they will demonetize that shorts, which I really don't care for because shorts are like, they don't get any money anyways. I mean, some money, I think the most successful shorts brought me €5 or something like that. So it's not really money that I was like 50 cents or like something like that. So it's not really a monetary game. It's more like a reach game. But Twitter is kind of like, I was never concerned. Like, it's also like a mental thing. Like, when I'm going on YouTube, I'm trying to like put something in a frame which does not offend YouTube. Just when I put like the thumbnail, the titles, the descriptions impact, because I will not cut anything out what the guest said. But when I think about everything that I can outside of that, I try to do a good job that the video gets as far as it can go on the YouTube platform. But on Twitter, like, I just put out stuff. Like, this is like my mindset is just way more free on Twitter, which I did not like. I had no reason to do that because I was never anything like any banned on YouTube. I had never a bad experience on YouTube, and I had never a bad experience on Twitter. So like, this mental thing is maybe just like a ghost in my head, but also experience from other people. And then we have other platforms like Mastodon, as you said, and Nostra is a big one, which you can also directly send Bitcoin and stuff like that. It works, but as you said, it's not a mass thing. Like, not a lot of people use it. Yes, the few really big guys there actually could make a living out of it, but they also have like a really big following somewhere else. And they need mass adoption in order to be really competitive to Twitter. But what I think, and I hope, maybe I'm just like a really hopeful person and a really positive thinking person, I hope that those kind of innovations and also Twitter going in a more freedom direction, that this just triggers that if you're not a freedom loving platform in the future, that people will go away from them. That like the freedom platforms are those where the people are more and more. I feel like Twitter got a lot of reach in the last 1 year, because people came back and it got way more. I feel like the conversations are more happening now on Twitter than before. The platform got more life into it. But it's funny how it goes. And I feel like, just as a content creator, I will do my best job possible to just like put the freedom word and the Bitcoin word out there. And if I get banned, I get banned. I have to live with that.
Yeah. No, I agree. I think that, you know, honestly, one thing that the folks at Twitter could do to really increase their support is fully open source their front end and back end for the entire site, so people can audit it, you know, in the open source community and say, oh yeah, this is what the algorithms are, and oh, this is what leads to you getting shadow banned and things like that.
I mean, they started doing that, but not completely, right? They have some type of algorithms is open source, but not everything, which is a step. I feel like also, like, this is a speculation on my side, but I feel like Elon Musk is trying to get in this direction, but he does not want to get too fast there. Like, he's slowly getting there, and you can see the steps he's implementing, because he's also seeing a platform that's working. And he does not want to break it too fast, so it's still working, because they also are depending on advertisement money and stuff like that. So it's funny how it goes. But I love the scene where he said like, "Fuck you to the creators." not to the creators, to the advertisers,
Disney,
and to Disney also. But on that note, do you see or do you witness a war on privacy, especially like on privacy on freedom right now? Like, do you see like the people like?
Absolutely. Congress just the U.S. Congress just passed what is effectively a TikTok ban. Now, I don't use TikTok, but the fact that Congress passed a bill that would effectively ban the use of a website is incredibly authoritarian. And, you know, the NSA has always been had their focus on abolishing people's privacy, especially in this digital day and age that we live in. And I don't think anything has gotten better on that front in the, you know, now 11 years since, Ed Snowden, you know, revealed what they were doing. I think if anything has gotten worse, especially with the implementation of AI, I can only imagine what the NSA is using AI for. Cause that just streamlines their, you know, information gathering. It's evil. It really is, especially because they're using private companies as their essentially their scapegoats, right? You know, they're effectively requiring companies to have these terms of use to where they're collecting data for the purpose of giving to the government, because the government is essentially holding them hostage and, you know, making them by tax incentives or whatever, you know, something that nobody in their right mind is going to turn down if it is voluntary. And I'm not even so sure that it is. But, you know, I've seen articles come out, like opinion pieces, saying that, oh yeah, you don't need to use VPNs anymore. Which kind of tells me that they're wanting to target VPNs, which is very, very concerning. I could see them launching an attack on Tor. For those who don't know what Tor is, it's the dark web. Launching attacks on Tor, launching attacks on even open source community items. I could see them spinning that as some crazy, you know, some crazy propagandized way to where, oh yeah, open source is evil for one reason or another, and they'll spin it in a way where the masses will ultimately believe it. And so that'll get rid of, you know, your aftermarket operating systems for your phone. It'll get rid of using Linux, you know, for the most part. I could see them going after, well, anything that's not based in the United States, and essentially turning the United States internet into what the Chinese and North Koreans get, which is nothing. And especially if they close all those bridges. You know, they're pushing hard on KYC for digital assets. You know, they just, well, I know you don't like, you know, keeping things, you know, with current events, but they just arrested, Roger Ver, on tax evasion, even though he's no longer a U.S. citizen. It is absolutely disgusting what they do. And I think that it's only going to get worse because, honestly, because Bitcoin and cryptocurrency is a threat to them, because people are waking up a little bit, and so they're going to use it to, they're going to use it as a weapon, you know, to make sure that people get into compliance. And I just see a lot of bad things happening. I really do.
Yeah, it's a massive threat to them. I mean, I just see, like, even in Austria and Germany. I just recently talked with, like yesterday, I talked with someone who has in a small town in his town where he's living in Freiburg. He's just going around and trying to motivate every restaurant, every shop to accept Bitcoin, just to like have those options. And they're really like passionate about it, and they're like, this is there, this option. As I'm like, I only hold Bitcoin. Like, I don't hold any fiat currencies. I just use it as a medium of exchange at this point, because I'm forced to do it. But if we are like fighting more and more for Bitcoin, and more and more merchants just accept Bitcoin because they can, then like if I could live, like if there would not be tax implications on Bitcoin and I could actually spend it directly, I would not use fiat. This is like, I'm only using fiat because I'm actually forced to do it. We're seeing countries where you're not forced to use it, as like El Salvador. There are even like in the Swiss, there's Lugano, where you can pay your taxes, or at least some taxes in Bitcoin, where you can pay most of the shops with Bitcoin and stuff like that. I recently interviewed a company which completely operates without a bank account in Swiss, which is amazing to me. So it's definitely a threat to it. Like it's fascinating to see.
Yeah, I would also be curious as to see how some of these countries expand their legal tender laws, because right now they, you know, legal tender laws for the most part are saying you must accept, you know, Federal Reserve notes or euros in exchange for your debts. I could see them expanding that to say you can only accept Federal Reserve notes or euros for exchange of goods and as payment of for legal tender. I could see that, and that would absolutely be devastating if they did that. I don't know what the reaction would be. Hopefully it would be one where they would be forced to undo something like that. But I could see the state doing that for sure.
Absolutely. And I feel like the states are getting more and more authoritarian. How do you keep, like, it's a different, maybe a weird question for you, but how do you keep like your optimism up? Like, how do you see, like, is Bitcoin one of the things where, like, okay, it's like a little bit of hope for the future? Is like, how do you maintain your hopefulness and optimism for the future?
It is very hard. I think anybody listening will understand that it is very hard. The world is not sunshines and rainbows. It is very, very evil, very very tyrannical, very oppressive. And the scary part is that your average person probably doesn't understand the extent to which, if they even understand that it is at all. Because essentially the world has transformed from nobles and peasants to elites and free-range peasants who don't know that they are free-range peasants. You'll see it with Americans all the time talking about how this is the land of the free, and it's like, no, no, it's not. And then they'll say something stupid like, well, go move to Somalia or something. It's like, okay, you don't understand what tyranny is, clearly, because of the fact that, there is no good place on the planet to live. It's all awful. And that's the world as it is. One thing I do is I try to help spread the message of liberty a lot. You know, like I've done with my book, and, you know, I post essays on Twitter, to try and help wake people up. And so there's some optimism there. I'm not alone in my views, clearly. I mean, you're along the lines too. And there are people waking up, and, you know, with more and more people getting into crypto, I think that is something that is positive as well. There are a few nuggets of optimism that can be viewed. And so I try and focus on those as much as I can, but I still know that the world is a shit place. Any place that the state exists is going to be a tyrannical shithole. But, you know, I'm looking to, I need to take care of me and my own. So that's where my focus is. I would love to change the world, and maybe one day one of my books or articles will, or at least have a hand in that. I don't have any delusions of grandeur that will ever happen, but, if I can help change a few people in the world, that's a few more than we had. And, it's easy to be pessimistic. And so I mainly focus on how I can improve the life, my life and my family's life. and how we can essentially live out our days in relative peace. So that's where my focus is.
Do you see El Salvador as one of those places? Because Bitcoin like to talk about El Salvador, but yeah, they also have their big flaws. But do you even observe El Salvador right now with Bitcoin and stuff like that?
Yeah, I remember when El Salvador added Bitcoin to their legal tender laws, and I thought that was amazing. Of course, time will tell, you know, what the political climate in El Salvador turns into be. Argentina is another one that I kind of have an eye on, but there are some things that Milei has been doing that I'm not excited about. It might just be as simple as building a cabin in the woods and, you know, being as far away as I can be from the state. But, I'm open to anything, anywhere. I would love to retire and in a place where I don't have to, where I can just be happy and my family's happy and healthy. And then ultimately that's all that matters. So, I'm always looking at other countries, if possible, if as a potential solution. But I'm not at retirement yet, so all of that could change, you know, over the next 20 years. So,
yeah, definitely. And I feel like I said it in the previous podcast, last year I was at Bitcoin Prague, and it's a kind of a different Bitcoin conference than the Bitcoin conference in America. It's like really focused more on privacy and freedom. I feel like from the crowd also, it's just a subjective feeling that I have there, and it's I compared it to more like a freedom conference and less than a Bitcoin conference. We talk a lot about privacy and a lot about freedom and stuff like that. So I feel like I'm really looking forward to June to this podcast, to this conference again, and because there will be a lot of like-minded people in real life, not just in podcast form, not just on Twitter. I'm always looking forward to that kind of conversations in real life. Before we end the podcast with our end routine, what are you currently extremely passionate about? Is there anything that we did not cover or about your passions that you're learning a lot or you're covering a lot in your life that we did not cover on the podcast till now?
I've just always been passionate about liberty generally, which is kind of why I am the way that I am and why I advocate for what I advocate for. But there is one thing that I am pursuing, or at least will be actively pursuing over the next year, and that's to get my pilot's license, because I think that will help open up more opportunities to explore places of potential retirement. I have always had a passion for flying, even though I've never, the last time that I flew a plane was in 2009. It was also the first time I flew a plane. I've always been interested in aviation. I've always wanted to get my pilot's license, and I'm finally going to start doing it. And, I think that could be a really cool way to, one, help spread the message of liberty, but also to, you know, expand my horizons beyond, where they currently are, and have the freedom to travel without having the TSA molest me.
I love it. I've flown twice as much as you. I have a friend of mine who is a pilot, and I flew with him two times, and I had the honor to land the two times and flew in the air a little bit, even though I have no clue about flying, but he explained a little bit to me, so I'm not completely lost, and he was always there. But it's a really nice feeling. I feel like I'm not in the life phase right now where I will do it, because I'm just really building stuff. But if I had like the time, I would love to do it. I would love to do it. For the end routine, we have end routine where the previous guest is asking a question for the next guest, which is always a difficult part because I don't control that kind of a question. And the previous guest does not know who the next guest is. So it can be a question where like the next guest does not know much about it. I will still ask it if you have an opinion on that, or if you know about that. When will the Bitcoin meme pool, a mempool, clear next, if at all?
Meme pool, like
mempool. It's not related to any meme.
Oh, it's not related to meme. I don't know what a Bitcoin mempool is. So I'm gonna say tomorrow. How about that? Tomorrow. Is that a good thing or a bad thing?
I think the mempool will not clear. Like it's been. What is a mempool? Like the mempool, you can see all the transactions, and every 10 minutes we have the blocks, and when right. It clears, there's no transaction in the block. Like this kind of this feeling, and I think it was last time happening over a year now. I think last April, maybe it was like a year ago. It could never happen again. Like I had last podcast guest Wicked on, and Wicked is extremely deep into like on a blockchain level of Bitcoin, which right. I'm not. Like I could not in deep explain to you what a mempool actually is. I'm trying to educate myself more and more, also with inviting guests like that, because I took a lot of notes. It's interesting to see the free market dynamics on the Bitcoin blockchain with transaction fees and stuff like that. That's also from a free market dynamics point of view, I think it's really interesting to see the fee development of Bitcoin, where we have some fees of like really high, because you can set your own fee. Like you can pay $1 million to transact 1 euro. Like you can do that if you want. Like nobody is holding you back from that, which is an interesting thought experiment. That's the question. But yeah, it's obviously not a good question, but I still wanted to give it to the next guest to keep the end routine going.
In that case, I would say that if it is going to happen again, I would say at the end of the bull market, the current bull cycle. I'll go with that.
Yeah, it's actually also been the longest time that it's not has been cleared for so long. Like we're in uncharted territory right now in the Bitcoin blockchain, if you will.
Interesting.
Before I let you go, where can people like ask you questions about the book, ask you a philosophical question, like where can people reach you in the best possible way?
So you can find me on Instagram at AncapEr. I'm very inactive there. I don't post a lot. If anything, I'm just kind of scrolling. The main place you can find me is on Twitter or X, whatever you want to call it, at AncapEr, at AncapAir. My DMs are open, or you can at me by all means. My book, you can find it on Amazon or Audible if you'd rather have the audiobook version. You'll get to hear my sexy voice narrated for you. So I don't know if that does anything for you, but it could be a selling point. So why not? I'm mostly on Twitter. I'm working on my second book now. This one's going to be a novel. So hopefully this writer's block ends quickly, because I really am excited about the direction of this book, where this book is going, but I just need to figure out how to get there.
Yeah, it's definitely a selling point. Like I'm an Audible fan. I'm unable to read books for some reason, but I consume books on Audible really good, and I can also remember stuff more. And when I read books, maybe I have some brain function, but I am getting bored so much, and then I drift off. And I'm a big Audible fan, and I always like when the author is speaking himself, especially when I know the author. And when someone is listening to that and they're not curious about the book, it's definitely a selling point. I feel like that's a good thing to do. And I would not do it differently with my book. I will always like have the narrations, even though it could be a time consuming, but it's like a one-time thing you have to do. It's like you invest the time. It's definitely good. And good that you did it. Then thank you for your time. Thank you for being on. It was a pleasure having you. And thank you for being on.
Well, thank you for having me. Thanks for the invite. This was a great conversation. I appreciate it.